The following sermon is presented by Maranatha Bible Church of Comstock Park, Michigan. For more information, go to mbcmi.org.
I'd like to start off just by hearing a couple things, how I came about this message. Now, most of you know me a little bit, and I really enjoy teasing people. It's kind of fun, you know, at least a levity in life, and just have a joy doing that. And however, there are three people that I have that I really don't tease. My wife. She knows better. Church secretary. She knows better. And since my daughter married into the family, I don't mess with Brenda anymore. However, everybody else is open territory. So, you know, as I was thinking about what to speak on this morning, you know, I was trying to come up with what can I do in order to really drive home what I feel I should be speaking on and how should I go about it. You know, I got to thinking as I was talking to my wife. I says, "Honey, I really got these ideas what I should do. Tell me what you think." I says, "First off, so people don't get out of the privilege and thinking of hearing Todd and Nate, I should grow a mustache and a goatee. And that way I'll get up here and then I'll bring a Meijer grocery bag full of stuff and pull stuff out of it and use it as illustrations." And I said, "No, I can't do that. The reason I can't do this is I'm not smart enough to do that. I am amazed at people that can take these common everyday items and make object lessons out of them. I never could do that, so I'm kind of jealous. Well, I can't do that, so I got an idea. I can be like Pastor Todd. I'll just take a verse, and let's say this verse is 36 words long, and I will stand up and say, today we are going to be looking at this verse. But this verse is so full of meaning that in order to flesh out the entire concept that is there, we are going to spend the next 12 weeks on that verse." Three words a day. And the first three words are, "And there was." I said, "Nah, I can't do that either." It just won't work. But then, I got to thinking even more. I know. I'll do Todd a favor. I'll finish in one message the Gospel of John. 3 points. Jesus finishes his life. He dies. He rises again. John's done. But then I got to thinking, no, I can't do that. I mean, why else would I want to deny? I mean, I couldn't imagine denying myself the privilege of hearing the Gospel of John on Sunday morning for the rest of my life. So I said, no, I can't do that. So today I decided to do something a little bit different. Oh, my wife's already covering your head. I'm in trouble. Because there's a... your time's coming. Just wait a second. But okay, we're going to be looking at something a little bit different, okay? Because we're going to be looking at a group of Bible books. Oh, by the way, I forgot something, because her time is now. So let me back up a little bit. I was doing all this with my wife, and then she decided to do something too. She got sucked into my craziness. Because then she said to me, "Honey." Now, when she says "honey," that's good. When she says "Chris," that's not good. Okay? So she said, "Honey, I got an idea for you. You can do something that hasn't been done for quite some time at this church. It'll be different. It'll be great. You can do this." And I go, "All right, great idea. What should I do?" She said, "You can preach a 30-minute sermon." And I said, "No, I can't do that either." And she goes, "Chris, I got about 20-some minutes left for marital harmony here." She used the name. So what we're going to do here is look at a book. A book that the average Christian, in all honesty, it's fairly unknown. We know this book is in the Bible, but we don't really deal too much with it because, you know, we just don't read it that much. The message seems to be very obscure, and we think that it has very little practical relevance for today. That group of books is called the Minor Prophets. And they're minor only in the sense that it refers to how long the book is, in contrast to the message, because the message of these books are very important because they're part of the inspired text. The book that we're going to look at today is the shortest book of those minor prophets, and indeed the shortest book within the whole Old Testament. We're going to get through the whole book today. One message. It can be done. This verse has 21 verses, which I find ironic, is exactly how many chapters are in the Gospel of John. And in all honesty, though, as we look at this, we're going to see that this book has a major message for us today. And hopefully, by the time we're done, this minor prophet's message will no longer be minor within our eyes. The book is Obadiah. Some of you have already figured it out. So turn with me in your copy of God's Word. And I trust that we'll see this book does have a major message for today. So you got Ezekiel, Daniel, Hosea, Joel, Amos, and then our book, Obadiah. Now, to understand this book, we have to comprehend the background very quickly. The author of this book is, by its title, Obadiah. Now, there's at least 12 different people within the Old Testament that are called Obadiah, but very little is known about this author of this book, except the name means a worshiper of Yahweh. Since we don't know much about the author, we don't likewise know much about the date because we can't really pinpoint when this was. So when we look at the book, we know that probably it was written anywhere from 848 B.C. to 586 B.C., sometime around a 262-year time span. What's the theme of this book? It's very easy. The theme of the book is about a country. Now, I like to remember it this way, and in fact, if you remember it this way, you probably will get this in your head, you'll never forget it. But you see the term Obadiah, right? Just put some hyphens in there. Obadiah is written about Obad-Edom. Obadiah is written about Obad-Edom. And you can see the prophet at that point going around, Bad-Edom. This was not a good country. Something that had been a thorn in the flesh for the nation of Israel for some time. Now, to explore the animosity real quick, I'd like you to turn to a couple of other passages. And I would like you to turn to Psalm 137. Put your finger there. And then turn back to Genesis chapter 25. The animosity between the Edomites and the Israelites is really one of the oldest examples of discord within human relationships. Turn back to Genesis 25. You have your finger in Psalm 137. And we're going to find here that this conflict started with a struggle between Jacob and Esau while they were in the womb of the mother Rebekah, picking it up in Genesis 25, verse 21. Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was barren. The Lord answered his prayer, and his wife Rebekah became pregnant. The babies jostled each other within her, and she said, "Why is this happening to me?" So she went to inquire of the Lord. The Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you will be separated. One people will be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger. When the time came for her to give birth, there were twin boys in her womb. The first to come out was red, and his whole body was like a hairy garment, so they named him Esau." This conflict began then, and eventually it got to the point that there was a time as these two were growing up. Years later, Esau was hungry. What happened? Look at what verse 30 says. He said to Jacob, Esau, "Quick, let me have some of that red stew. I am famished." That is why they called him what? Edom. Edom means red, red stew in this case. The word is kind of indicating that for us. And Esau then moved ultimately southeast of the Dead Sea into a red sandstone area. And there his descendants conquered the people of that land. Now, you know, as time went on throughout history, Edom and Israel continued to have conflict. We will find that the first conflict between Edom and Israel occurred when the nation of Israel was trying to pass through the land on their wilderness wanderings in order to get to the land of promise. And Edom says, "No, it's not going to happen. We are not going to allow it." And Israel had to take a detour then around them because they weren't going to permit them to go through the land. And even though they mistreated their relatives, the nation, God said, "Israel, you're not to hate that country. You are to continue to have the right perspective and the right attitudes toward." But you know what? Even then, Edom continued throughout history to give Israel a very difficult time. And you would find that Edom was a thorn in the flesh throughout all of the kings of Israel, especially under David, under Solomon, and under a host of others, as they continued to have conflict and problems in persecuting and causing difficulty within the nation of Israel. Well, it eventually got to a point that as history went on, that we find that Edom would revolt against Israel, would cause problems continually, and as history went on up to 586 BC, when the nation of Babylon came and destroyed and conquered Jerusalem, we find Edom doing something very unique, and that's reflected in Psalm 137. So turn there real quick, because we'll notice what the Edomites did. Notice what happened and what God records for us in verse 7. Remember, O Lord, what the Edomites did on the day that Jerusalem fell. What did they do? Tear it down, they cried. Tear it down to its foundations. They encouraged Babylon to literally destroy Jerusalem. Take it down. We want them gone. Now, my friends, we see with Edom constantly striving as a thorn in the flesh to the nation of Israel, and God said enough was enough. So God sends the prophet Obadiah to give this message of judgment to them, to tell them what is going to occur within their lives and within their lands. That's the background as we come here to the book of Obadiah. So you should be back now to Obadiah, because now we have 3 points to get across as we look at this book today, and then also to spend some time in personal application. The first 9 verses give us what I'm going to call a manifestation of pride. Let's read those first 9 verses, and I am reading, if you can't tell, out of the New International Version. The vision of Obadiah. This is what the sovereign Lord says about Edom. We have heard a message from the Lord. An envoy was sent to the nations to say, "Rise and let us go against her for battle. See, I will make you small amongst the nations. You will be utterly despised. The pride of your heart has deceived you, you who live in the clefts of the rocks and make your home on the heights. And you say to yourself, 'Who can bring me down to the ground?' Though you soar like the eagle and make your nest amongst the stars, from there I will bring you down, declares the Lord. If thieves come to you, if robbers in the night, oh, what disaster awaits you. Would they not steal only as much as they wanted? If grape pickers came to you, wouldn't they leave a few grapes? But how Esau will be ransacked. Their hidden treasures are pillaged. All your allies will force you to the border. Your friends will deceive and overpower you. Those who eat your bread will set a trap for you, but you will not detect it. In that day, declares the Lord, will I not destroy the wise men of Edom, men of understanding in the mountains of Esau? Your warriors of Teman will be terrified, and everyone in Esau's mountains will be cut down in slaughter." The first verse literally is telling us to listen closely. Here, Obadiah, in a vision, is seeing, if you will, mentally and spiritually, what the Lord is going to communicate to him, and he is going to now communicate clearly to the people of that day and to us what God is going to do. And notice, it's what the sovereign Lord says about Edom, as the envoy is going to go to the nations and say, "Let's rise up in battle against Edom." Now that verse, and we'll apply this, you know, down the road here, but it's intriguing to me here is God is using those nations to accomplish his will, isn't he? This sovereign Lord is immediately beginning to perk our ears up and say he's the one in charge of what is going to happen, and therefore we had better listen, because what he has to say is something of intense significance. In verses 2 through 9 here, we're going to see Edom's main problem. And that main problem, we've already seen it. Verse 3 says it clearly, the pride of their heart. And we're going to see in these verses is how that pride was manifest, and how it then resulted in them acting and living in certain ways. First of all, in verses 2 through 3, we see this, that their pride is manifested in their position or location, and God is going to humiliate them. Did you see what it says in verse 2? Look what he's going to do. See, I'm going to make you small among the nations. You're going to be small and utterly despised. When I'm done in judgment with you, you are going to be one of utter and sheer insignificance. In fact, it's written in a way that is signifying that what God has said here is as good as done. Why is it? Because of the pride of their heart. You know, it's interesting when you look at that word pride. It literally means a boasting. It literally means to boil up, to be presumptuous. And I find it interesting here, because I really wonder if the author in this text is trying to get us to focus back on what was read in Genesis chapter 25. Because that word of pride means to boil up, which is the same word that was used for the cooking of Jacob as he boiled the stew for his brother Esau. And maybe God at this point is suggesting that this stew that the ancestor ate is portraying how they are now acting. Boiled up in pride and arrogance, thinking that they could do anything they wanted because everything was safe, everything was good within their own life and living. Well, notice what it says in verse 3. The pride of your heart has deceived you who live in the clefts or the clefts of the rock. An amazing sight is in Amman, Jordan, or actually in the country of Jordan. Because what this is talking about here is where the location of these people lived at. They lived in a city called Petra. Now, if any of you have ever had the privilege of going on a Holy Land tour, maybe you have gone to see Petra. If any of you are planning on going to a Holy Land tour, this is one archaeological site that you should go see. It is an amazing, incredible item. And in fact, I think nowadays, and I believe now, when I went on a tour back in 1978, this was part of the package. Now it's an add-on to the tour. You had better buy it because it's worth every dime you will spend. But when I went over there in the Holy Land tour in 1978, I flew from, first leg was from JFK Airport in New York City to Amman, Jordan, 14 hours on the plane. Left at 11 at night, got there at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and you talking about jet lag, I'm glad I was young. Could not do it now. Well, anyway, we went to bed that night around 10:30, and all of a sudden, I come bolting out of bed at 4 a.m. as all of a sudden, loudspeakers blaring all over the place for the Muslim call to prayer. Now, I was a guy from Ohio in an Amish-type area. You don't make noise like that at 4 a.m. I had no clue what was going on. So I had to ask the guide, what is this stuff, you know? So that was amazing. But anyway, we got on the bus that morning and went down to Petra. Got out of the bus and I got on my first camel ride. Because in order to get back to Petra, it's a fairly well-concealed place. In fact, it's so well-concealed that they didn't even find this place in modern-day times until the early 1800s. But you get on your camel and you go through a narrow crack in the earth to the ruins of the city. And in fact, the path that you go on is so narrow that two camels will not hardly even fit there most of the time. It's only meant for a single file to get down through there. You look up and you can only see a small sliver of the sky because the canyon walls are hundreds and hundreds of feet high. Well, you go around all kinds of curves, the channel gets big at times, then it gets narrow, and then all of a sudden, rounding a curve, you're thrust into an expansive walled valley, and immediately your attention is transfixed on a huge, magnificent building that's carved out of red stone. You look around, you see the walls, you see them expanding 100, 700 feet high in places, with caves all across there where people lived. And it's easy to see how these individuals and the inhabitants of that land saw this as a place of great security. It resulted in them being fearlessly independent. They were ones that were confident in their impregnable fortress that nothing could bring them down. Now, by the way, just an aside, a lot of you, whether you realize it or not, have probably seen Petra. Haven't been there. But actually, it's a city that has appeared in quite a few pictures and movies. Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, one of the most notable, filmed there because of the magnificent structure that it is. And for us that's been there, we recognize it immediately when we see it because it's that obvious because it's such an amazing sight. Well, these individuals, very well protected, secure in their location, secure in their position. And God says that pride, that arrogance that thinks that nothing can happen, I got news for you. You dwell and soar like the eagles, or so you think. But yet God is going to swoop down like an eagle. And he is going to do his work and bring them down. Verse 4, right? You know, these individuals who thought that nothing could happen to them, maybe inaccessible to man, were easily accessible to God. Judgment, even in a fortress like Petra, will be no problem to the sovereign God when he so determines it to be done. Well, we also find in verses 5 and 6, pride in one's wealth. And what does God do? God makes it disappear. Now, this is kind of an interesting verse in verses 5 to 6. And let me just give you the big picture here. Because these people apparently were fairly well off. They had treasures that were buried. They had all kinds of good things happening because they were on a major trade route. A lot of trade was going on between them. They had it made, not only from a security perspective, so they thought, but also from a finance perspective. They were very wealthy. And God says, you know what? Think about it this way. If thieves come to you, don't they only take as much as they want? And the idea here is when a thief comes in, do they take everything or do they leave a lot behind? You know, a little ways back, I think it was 2003, Gloria and I, our house was broken into. We had somebody that came in and quite frankly did us a favor. You know, they took a 1989 stereo with a record player. And it's, okay, we got a new stereo out of it. You know, they took a VCR. I mean, come on, what's the market value of a VCR? They took a bunch of Christian CDs, which doesn't make any sense to me to pawn Christian CDs that you stole. That goes against my way of thinking. But they did find a couple things, or one thing primarily of value, but they left a lot of things that was invaluable that they just didn't find or they didn't even try to look for. They wanted to get in and out. But the fact is, they didn't clean out the entirety of the house. They only took a certain thing and then left. Another illustration. What about those grape pickers, the one who harvests? Do they get 100% of everything or do they leave some things there? They don't get everything, do they? In fact, in Old Testament times, they were supposed to leave some things so that the poor could gather them. Well, by contrast, here's people who have a lot of wealth, and what is God going to do? Esau is going to be ransacked. The treasures will be pillaged. And the idea here is that the invaders, the people that are going to judge you, they're going to take everything. You're not going to have anything left. God's judgment will be total, full, and complete. Well, they also had pride in another area in verse 7. Pride in their security with others. Apparently, they had allies, right? These allies were ones maybe they forged those trade relationships with. They had good relations with other countries. They had forged those things, and they felt, you know, if anything happens, we'll be okay. We have others that's going to help us out. Well, what happens, though, in this, in God's judgment? Their friends, their allies, are going to deceive and overpower them. Those who eat your bread, those that are close to them, are going to set a trap, and they will not even detect it. Edom, deceived by their own pride, was going to be deceived by their own enemies. They would not even be protected by the ones that they forged the relationship with when God's judgment comes. Verses 8 and 9 tells us this. They had pride in their wisdom and also their soldiers. And you know what God does? He makes them no effect as the people are to be slaughtered, as verse 9 says. In other words, here were people. We got all the wise men here in our town. We got everything going for us in this area. We got a lot of good scholars, a lot of good people. We don't have anything to worry about in all our military. It's really a class act. Things are really well there, so we again don't have anything to worry about. But when God's judgment comes, he's going to destroy the wise men. The warriors will be terrified, and God's judgment will come as the people will be devastated. You know, it seems like to me in the first 9 verses of this prophecy, the very structure of society in its whole is going to be decimated by God. And those people who felt that they had everything going for them, a great security in their well-being, in their wise rule, in their military, in their international treaties with others, everything was great. However, God said all of them will be toppled. And you and your arrogance will lead to complete humiliation when his judgment is come. Nothing can render her safe. And you know, immediately at the outset, it's almost being told, we almost are forced to look at how false hope and pride and what the result of that is when we try to find security in anything but God. And that's exactly what these people were doing. Trying to find security in anything but in a relationship with the Redeemer. And God, in his judgment, said, because of the way you've acted and dealt with the nation of Israel, this is what's going to happen. Well, in verses 10 through 14, we have some interesting things because they were puffed up in this pride. But you know what? It led to them to act in a certain way. And we're going to just quickly get through this section in verses 10 through 14. Let's read those together. Because of the violence against your brother Jacob, you will be covered with shame. You will be destroyed forever. On the day that you stood aloof while strangers carried off his wealth and foreigners entered his gates and cast lots for Jerusalem, you were like one of them. You should not look down on your brother in the day of his misfortune, nor rejoice over the people of Judah in the day of their destruction, nor boast so much in the day of their trouble. You should not march through the gates of my people in the day of their disaster, nor look down on them in their calamity in the day of their disaster, nor seize their wealth in the day of their disaster. You should not wait at the crossroads to cut down their fugitives, nor hand over their survivors in the day of their trouble. Now, Obadiah here, sensing the intensity of God's judgment, then states this is what they were doing in their life and lifestyle that was the result of their pride that was now again causing God to judge them. Verses 10 through 12 demonstrates for us sinful actions that they were doing. Violence against their brother Jacob. Do you notice how the two words are put there? Violence against your brother? Does that make sense? But yet they're related. And they were manifesting violent, hurtful, oppressive cruelty against the descendants of Jacob. And God here is saying that this is going to be dealt with. The actions that you had in your continual violence against these people is what is causing this judgment to come. Now, by the way, just for your own amazement, violence is a very interesting word in the Hebrew text. And I'm not going to give you the Hebrew solely because I can't pronounce it anymore probably, but you'll get this one. You know how you spell the word for violence? H-A-M-A-S. Hamas. Ring a bell? Interesting, isn't it? Because here, these individuals were violent, acting in an unbrotherly way against their relatives. They were ones that even stood aloof, it says in verse 11, when the nations carried off their wealth, they did nothing to intervene. And when the armies came to enter into Jerusalem, they cast lots to see which and who would be able to invade which section of Jerusalem. Here, these sinful attitudes of unbrotherliness and then mockery in verse 12 of making fun and gloating and rejoicing over their destruction was going to be met by the judgment of God. You see, these individuals, once you have pride that's welled up within you, it just doesn't stop there. It leads to sinful attitudes, unbrotherliness, rejoicing and boasting when others don't have it as good. But it also leads to sinful actions, as verses 13 to 14 says, because these individuals now began to participate in the things that they were rejoicing in earlier, where now these individuals themselves were going into Jerusalem and were now looking down on them in the day of their calamity. They were seizing their wealth, and it just didn't stop there because they began to collaborate with the enemies of the nation of Israel. Can you imagine your relatives collaborating with the enemy so that when the enemies attack the nation of Israel and people try to run away to get away from it all, that their own relatives capture them and turn them over to the enemies? What Edom did. You know, my friends, what God at this point is doing for us is he's kind of painting a picture. Here we have the nation of Israel who has been under consistent treatment by the nation of Edom in inappropriate ways. God said, enough is enough, and the pride that you have had within you that has resulted in you living and acting in a certain way is indeed going to be judged and dealt with. And he tells us then in the remaining portion of this book, verses 15 to 21, that God is coming to make things right. Now, the hardship that we have with verses 15 through 21 is you could spend quite a bit of time on this text. And I just want to kind of take this from a big picture perspective, in the sense that this verse, these passages here, the remaining section, seems to me to kind of give hope and encouragement to the people of that day and also pointing to what God is going to be doing in the future. If you will, it serves a dual purpose. Because here in verses 15 to 21, we're going to find God encouraging and telling the nation of Israel what is going to happen in the midst of the difficulty they're going through, but also is pointing to a future time when God is coming in a very direct way to intervene in the lives of the world in which we live in a direct way, yet to come. Let's look at verse 15 because we're going to see his judgment. The day of the Lord is near for all nations. As you have done, it will be done to you. Your deeds will return upon your head. Just as you drank on my holy hill, so all nations will drink continually. They will drink and drink, and it will be as if it had never been. Here God is saying, look, Edom, you're going to be judged. It's going to happen. And you are going to be judged in a way exactly how you treated the nation of Israel. It happened. Edom was destroyed under God's hand. You know, is there coming a time in the future where God is likewise going to judge? Yeah. There's going to come a time he's going to make all things right down the road. Don't we wish it was today? I know I do. But yet it's only in God's hands as to when it is. There's going to come a time where that is going to happen. God's judgment is indeed going to come. And then we're going to notice in verses 70 to 21 the blessings that God is going to bring when he brings his judgment and how it is going to then impact the nation of Israel and the future. But on Mount Zion, by contrast, is going to be what? Deliverance. It will be holy. The house of Jacob will possess its inheritance. The house of Jacob will be a fire. The house of Joseph a flame. But what? Esau will be stubble. They will set it on fire and consume it. There will be no survivors from the house of Esau. The Lord has spoken. People from the Negev will occupy the mountains of Esau. The people of the foothills will possess the land of the Philistines. They will occupy the fields of Ephraim and Samaria. Then Benjamin will possess Gilead. The company of Israelite exiles who are in Canaan will possess the land as far as Zarephath. The exiles from Jerusalem who are in, I've always had trouble with that word, Sepharad, will possess the towns of the Negev. Deliverers will go up to Mount Zion to govern the mountains of Esau, and the kingdom will be who? The Lord's, right? It will be his. And what these verses are clearly demonstrating to the people of that day is that Israel is to be delivered. Likewise going to happen in the future, right? Israel is going to be in the land. They're going to occupy the land that God intended to give them, which likewise is going to be happening yet in the future. You know, it's so funny to me. I don't know. I get so tired of listening to the news and hearing these kind of things. You know, Israel's in occupied territory. No, it's not. You're in occupied territory. You're in their territory, believe it or not. And eventually, it's going to be theirs. And you're not going to be able to do anything about it. God says, here it is. You're done that quick. You know, God is the one that's going to put Israel in the land. He did it then. He's going to do it, you know, yet in the future. And then God's kingdom ultimately will be established. People will be set up, and the kingdom will be who? The Lord's. Now, you know, big picture for the book of Obadiah. As we go into the rest of our time this morning to some applications for us today, is that, you know, God does set things right. And here we have a nation, Edom, that continued to persecute the nation of Israel because of the pride and arrogance of their heart, which led to them acting and having inner perspectives that were totally against what God expected. And God says, you know, you will be judged. I will make it right in my way and in my time. And he did so with Edom and for the nation of Israel. Now, I don't know where you're at within your personal life, but I know that I've been through quite a bit of things in life. Things where I have had people that have done things to me that just haven't been right from a biblical perspective. On the other hand, I know that probably, I know you find it's hard to believe that I was probably the cause of some of those things and I could have done things a little bit differently. But yet, you know what? God made things right. And the hardship that we have in going through those kind of things is that we sure wish our time frame was the same as God's time frame. And too often, we try to put pressure or try to find immediately what is going on in my life and why did this happen when God's using this to grow us to be more like his son. There are times I know that I've seen things and I just, man, God, are you even here? Are you helping? What's going on? And all the time, he's at work in ways that I don't even know and I can't even imagine. But he brings about his grace and his way and his time. And what's always been incredible to me is that as you look back from 3-4 years down the road, it's so clear to see what God was done, but so hard to go through it in the meantime. In other words, God does make things right. And what Israel was going through and what Israel was dealing with, God made right in his time. Greatly to be encouraged from us. Now look at verse 1 real quick. Verse 1, I think, is an amazing verse, and let's see where your theology will take you with this verse and how much you believe in the sovereign Lord and what he said about Edom. An envoy was sent to the nation to say, "Rise and let us go against her for battle." Do you realize and believe that God is actively involved in the actions and affairs of mankind? We are under the control of a moral God. We are under control of God who has all things in his hands. We do not need to wring our hands in despair, if you will, or shrug our shoulders, because God's providence is a powerful factor who was ultimately going to right wrongs. Now, it's really interesting to me here is that God is using other nations to accomplish his will. Did you notice that? He's using other nations to accomplish what he wanted. Now, I'm sure that when the nations went up and attacked Edom, they more than likely thought, hey, this is what we're going to do. We have made our decision. It's all us. But yet God says what? It was his hand that ultimately was at work in the entire process. Do you really believe that? Do you really believe that? You know, Proverbs 21:1 says this, "King's heart is in the hands of the Lord. God turns it whatever way he desires." How far do you want to believe that? I mean, it's easy for us today to say, you know, this military buildup, Iraq, Afghanistan, George Bush, yeah, God's at work there because this, you know, depending on your political persuasion, honestly, this is the right thing to do. Okay, well then, what about the Emperor of Japan in 1941? Was God at work there? Directing the king's heart to fulfill his will? What about with the evil people that we don't want to like to talk about? A Hitler, a Mussolini, the guy in Venezuela, what, Chavez, that's a thorn in the flesh of America, it seems like today. Was God at work in the hearts of those kings, directing it to accomplish his plan? Do you really believe that? In other words, would it be wise for us to suggest, as Obadiah 1, verse 1 is telling us, is that we have to look at military actions, not just from a political point of view, but rather from what God is doing in the world today in order to work out his will and his purposes, because are not all these things being done to lead to the final consummation of when Jesus comes to implement ultimately a perfect reign here upon earth? Are you willing to admit that? Because Obadiah is clearly leading us within that direction. Well, the most obvious application from all this is pride comes before a fall, right? You pretty well see this. Now, you know what I find it interesting today is that this nation prided themselves on certain things. Wealthy. Security. We got a great defense. We had a lot of wise people around too, right? A lot of smart people. We have gotten these alliances that we've established with our partners. So we're pretty well safe. Nothing can happen to us. You really believe that? Because God took him down. Now, you know, I'm not saying God's going to do anything to any certain specific country, but there's a lot of countries that probably believe the same thing that Edom did back at this time frame within the Old Testament. They're not immune to the judgment of God either. What about in your personal lives? Isn't it very easy for us to, whether we realize it or not, get welled up with pride in the sense, you know, I got to establish security for me and my family. I got to work hard. I got to Yeah, I said this last sermon. Have my $1 million before I retire, because that's what I'm going to need, according to all these financial planners. I got to make sure I'm in a great job that's in a great rate of pay, because that's what I need in order to be secure. I got to have a house fully paid for. Maybe a position that has some prestige to it, because that's what's looked upon as important. It's very easy for us to get locked in to what the world's thinking and try to do these things and leave God out of the picture. Is it easy for us to do? Can we get locked into this line of thinking where we unwittingly have fallen into an area of pride where we're trying to provide and work and do things in a way that is going to give us security so that when negative things happen, we won't be affected? But have you kept God in the picture in so doing? Now, I know that's something I've talked about with even recently some people within this church. Because you get to the point, you know, I just like to continue to strategize in the future. You know, wouldn't it be great if you could raise enough money to support yourself in short-term missions work? And when I say raising the money, namely having it within your bank account so that you don't have to ask for support. And I keep thinking to myself, isn't that a form of pride? Because I don't want to have others help. I want to rely on what I've done instead of what others can do as God works within their life. When is enough enough? The continual question goes on. Pride can easily creep in ways that you don't even think about or imagine. Well, what does God say about pride, right? He hates it, doesn't he? Something that should not be part of our life at all. We should hate what God hates. We should be ones that are committing ourselves to living in a way that's going to please and honor Him. You know, I found it interesting in another verse here where we talk about unbrotherliness in verse 10. I mean, we need to be doing good to those who hate us. Do you realize that? Really, Obadiah is teaching that too, also to us. God told them in the nation of that since they were related, that they were to act properly and live in a way correctly because of that relationship that they had. But isn't it interesting to me that in Matthew chapter 5, we hear God saying what? Do good to those who hate you and persecute you. We need to respond well to them. Israel tried to do that the best that they were able as Edom continued to do those things against them. Lastly, let us be encouraged by this one thing. Verse 21, the king is building his kingdom and he will prevail. It's not a matter of if, it's when. He will prevail. God is going to undo the wrongs, if you will, that we experience today because his kingdom is working ahead and is ultimately going to culminate with the establishment of his rule and reign on earth before the ushering in of the eternal state. He will prevail. It's not a matter of if, it's when. And if that is the case, is the king that is coming your king? Do you know that? Is he your king? Because when he comes, which he will be, we are either going to be bowing down before him because that's been a part of our life all of our days because we've committed our life to Christ, or you'll be bowing before him in terror because judgment has arrived. The question you should be asking yourself at this point is the king that is coming, since he will prevail, is he mine? Do I have that relationship with him? If you don't, then you need to make that decision today. You know, this short book of Obadiah gives a penetrating message. It comes thundering through the pages of the Old Testament, telling us that God is coming. He's going to take care of his people. He is going to take care of us and warns us against pride that is coming up within our heart, in our lives, within our church, our country. Be careful, because God will deal with it well. You know, this summer has been an interesting summer for a variety of reasons. But believe it or not, I don't know if you heard of this or not, there was a very significant death that likewise occurred. The man's name was, I'll try to do this right, Mamafku Ondo. He died at age 96 from heart failure. Mamafku Ando. You don't know him, do you? But he died. You might not know him, but you do know his major creation that he made in 1948. They were a major hit, and they became an instant hit as the staple diet for all college students. Ramen noodles. He died this summer. It was tragic. Well, what you don't know is this man had a saying of wisdom. And his saying of wisdom, he would pass on to everyone. And you know part of this, right? Give a man a fish, you feed him for a meal. Teach a man to fish, you feed him for a lifetime. Well, this man expanded on that with another line. Teach a man to fish, you feed him for a lifetime. Give him ramen noodles, and you don't have to teach him anything. Now, what does this have to do with this message? Okay, good question. You know, many times when we hear God's word taught, we kind of respond that way. Give me the word. Will I learn, though, from it? Will I be taught? Will I listen to what God's word is saying? You know, at the end of our bulletin at the end of our outline that you have in your bulletin every day, it's almost like saying, how's God working in your life with this message? Because too often when we hear God's word, we kind of lock it in. All right, good message, decent message, whatever. But yet, I'm sure glad you spoke on that because so-and-so really needed it. What about within our lives, we feel that everything is okay, that we don't need to change, and when God's word thunders through, we miss it. But the point is that God, regardless, holds you accountable for what has been taught. Of to analyze your own life to make sure that your life is being done in a way that He is happy and that He is pleased with. So as you hear the words of this minor prophet that has a major message, how will you respond to the truths that have been contained?
You've been listening to a sermon presented at Maranatha Bible Church in Comstock Park, Michigan, where we exist to display God's glory, declare God's truth, delight in God's Son, and disciple God's people. No part of this digital file may be reproduced or distributed without prior written consent. For permission, go to mbcmi.org.